and welcome to Discussions with DPIC. I'm Robin Conrad, the Director of Research and Special Projects at the Death Penalty Information Center. Today, we are joined by Isaiah McCoy, a man who was wrongfully convicted and sentenced to death in Delaware in 2012, and his two attorneys, Michael Wiseman and Herb Mondrose. Isaiah McCoy spent over 4 years on death row for a crime that he did not commit. His case demonstrates several of the fundamental flaws within the criminal justice system. There was no physical evidence linking Isaiah to the murder for which he was convicted. Two eyewitnesses who testified against him both received deals from the prosecutor and told multiple versions of the story about the crime. David Favada, the deputy attorney general who prosecuted Isaiah McCoy, was suspended from the practice of law due to his outrageous and unethical conduct in Isaiah's case. Isaiah's jury was not unanimous in recommending a sentence of death, a practice that the Delaware Supreme Court has since found to be unconstitutional. Isaiah was fortunate to have excellent attorneys who successfully challenged his conviction and sentence on appeal. Isaiah was released from prison after being found not guilty during his retrial in January 2017. Isaiah McCoy is the 157th person exonerated from death row in the United States. We are excited to speak with Isaiah and his attorneys. Hello and welcome.
Hi.
All right. Thank you for having us.
You're very welcome. Michael and Herb, can you start us off and tell us about the circumstances of the crime that resulted in Mr. McCoy's arrest?
Sure. There was an alleged robbery, and a shooting in a bowling alley in Dover, Delaware. And one of the people who was implicated in setting up the alleged drug deal that led to the shooting essentially falsely implicated Isaiah McCoy as having been involved. And from there, the police arrested him. He went through a couple of years of litigation before he was convicted in 2012. And most significantly, he represented himself at his first trial and did a fabulous job. He should have won then. But in our view, due to the really gross misconduct of the trial prosecutor at that time, he was unfortunately convicted and sentenced to death. I think Herb should pick it up from there. He got involved after the sentence of death was imposed.
Yeah, that's right. We were contacted in August of 2013 to consult with Isaiah about his direct appeal, and he ended up retaining Carl Schwartz and I, Eric Barron and I, for the direct appeal. We filed an appeal with the Delaware Supreme Court that ultimately resulted in the reversal of Isaiah's conviction and death sentence and remand to the Superior Court for a new trial. That was in January of 2015. And then a few months later, the Supreme Court came down with another opinion on Isaiah's case, in which was a case brought by the Office of Disciplinary Counsel against David Favada, who was McCoy's prosecutor. And it found that Favada had committed multiple ethical violations during Mr. McCoy's trial and suspended the prosecutor Favada from the practice of law for 6 years, for 6 months and 1 day. The implication of the 1 day was that the extra day required him to petition to be reinstated to the practice of law, which he has not done. So Favada was essentially barred from the practice of law as a result of the misconduct during Isaiah's trial. First trial.
That's very interesting, Herb, and I would like you to tell our listeners what exactly the misconduct was that occurred during Isaiah's first trial.
It's reflected in the Supreme Court's opinion. It's probably the most outrageous, egregious, pervasive misconduct that certainly has ever been reported in Delaware. It ranged from lying to the trial court, threatening Mr. McCoy outside of the court in the jury's presence. Mr. Favada actually followed through with some of his threats and falsely exposed Mr. McCoy as being a snitch in a letter that he wrote to prison authorities. Throughout the trial, The prosecutors belittled Mr. McCoy for representing himself, interfered with his efforts to represent himself, and the Supreme Court found that the prosecutor had interfered with the administration of justice, engaged in dishonesty, deceit, and misconduct designed to interfere with the administration of justice. It was just from the get-go through the imposition of the death sentence. It was just rife with prosecutorial misconduct.
Wow, it sounds like a laundry list of things. Now, Isaiah, I'd like to ask you, at your first trial, we know that you represented yourself. Can you let us know when this happened and why did you choose to do that, and tell the listeners a little bit more about your decision, and maybe also talk about the prosecutorial misconduct, because you were there and experiencing what happened?
The attorneys that were representing me at the time, I didn't feel as though they prepared themselves properly to represent me. The theory of defense wasn't developed until the day of trial. There was no evidence whatsoever that put me at the scene of the crime other than alleged accomplices who had continued to be dishonest with homicide detectives, prosecutors, and anybody that would listen to him. But yet, he came up with a theory where he wanted to put me at the scene of the crime even when the evidence was clear that I wasn't at the scene of the crime. Previously, the 2 years leading up to trial, I did a lot of preparation, you know, in regards to the law, the trial process. So when the trial came, I was fully prepared to represent myself.
And when exactly did you decide to represent yourself?
During jury selection. I went to trial in May of 2012. But originally, I started trial in January of 2012. But during jury selection, my lead attorney essentially had a stroke. And I kind of took that as a sign at that point, you know, from God, possibly, that this guy is not going to help you. He's not going to do his job. So at the next trial, you know, during jury selection, it's just, I want to say a spirit moved me or my intuition, but it just made me make the decision that it would be best for me to exercise my constitutional right to represent myself.
What was it like to be up against a prosecutor who was acting unethically, actions that would later cause him to be suspended from the practice of law?
Mr. Provada underestimated his opponent. He assumed, due to the fact that I wasn't actually an attorney, that I would be unfamiliar with the rules of the court and the procedures of the court. And he was shocked and unprepared when I was well-versed in the law and all applicable procedures. At that point in time, he realized that he was going to lose, essentially. So at that point, he did everything in his power to prevent an acquittal. By any means necessary, I guess, was kind of like his motto, because his misconduct was like, it was clear, it was on the record, it was nonstop. His unethical conduct knew no bounds. As my attorney's already pointed out, you know, doing things to just merely try to make me uncomfortable, doing things to stop me from properly representing myself. And the thing was this: because he's an attorney and I was not, he manipulated the judge, because the judge would like to think that he can believe his officers of the court, attorneys who've been practicing for over 20 years. So he manipulated the court to his own advantage. He knew he had a losing case. That the evidence in the case was very clear, and he knew that the only way for him to get a conviction was to engage in misconduct. And further, he didn't properly prepare his case. You know, his investigator didn't do a proper investigation. So rather than coming to court and being a minister of justice and trialing the case with the evidence that he had as a minister of justice, he instead chose to engage in misconduct.
This is Michael jumping in. One of the most petty examples of the misconduct, and yet so significant, petty in the sense that it was petty of the prosecutor, but yet had a great impact on the proceedings, was that Mr. McCoy had standby counsel sitting there with him who, you know, had some familiarity with the case, obviously. And whenever they would try to grab his attention to give him some advice, the prosecutors would object, and they took the position, which the judge enforced, that only Mr. McCoy could initiate contact with standby counsel and not the other way around. That was just so petty. As a lawyer, reading that transcript, you're just aghast that a prosecutor would be so small-minded as to try to prevent his opponent from seeking the advice to which he was entitled. And that just, I think that's one of the grounds that the Supreme Court of Delaware reversed on, and cited as an example of his really terrible behavior.
This was, after all, Mr. McCoy's first time he tried a capital murder case.
And also, just to further point this out, Mr. Favada had a reputation for behaving in this manner. The only difference between my case and a lot of other cases is the incredible attorneys that I had on my team. Because they weren't seeking to please the prosecutors or the state of Delaware, they did their job. I mean, Eric Barron, he used to be the counsel for former Vice President Joe Biden. He was lights out. I mean, from his oral arguments to his brief, the man was really a godsend. I mean, really an expert. I've had nothing but experts from Michael Wiseman to Eric Barron to Mr. Mondros. It's just been a team effort.
Wow, you really had a great team after you were wrongfully convicted. But I want to ask you one additional question about your trial. Once you had been found guilty, you then had to present a case for life to the jury. How did you handle putting on mitigating evidence, asking the jury to spare your life when you shouldn't have even been convicted?
If I did, it would have been, you know, unfair to myself, being an innocent man, to participate in what I felt was a farce by that point. You know, if they wrongfully convicted me, why would I then beg for my life? I felt like that was a dishonorable act that I wasn't willing to indulge in.
And it was a good thing I wasn't representing him then, or we would have had a real problem. But his standby counsel did present the court with some mitigation information. That was compelling, you know, obviously without any advocacy or any further contextualization of that information, the jury and the judge had no problem deciding on death.
After your appeal, the Delaware Supreme Court said you were entitled to a new trial, so they vacated your conviction and sentence. Explain what happened after that for our listeners. What happened once your conviction was vacated? What happened then?
Okay, once my conviction was vacated, I was moved from death row. They came to me. I wasn't even aware that my case had been overturned. The correctional officer just came to my cell with a cart. He said, pack your belongings, at which point I realized my case had been overturned. At that point, we realized that we're getting ready for a new trial. And at that point, we brought one of the best attorneys in the country. We put him on board, Mr. Michael Wiseman. You know, I'm sure you've heard of him. and we just began preparation for trial. One of the main things that my attorney did immediately was to put in a motion to the Superior Court to have me moved out of solitary confinement. I was in solitary confinement for about 5.5 to 6 years in an area where I only came out of my room 3 times a week for 45 minutes. So in order to essentially heal me mentally, you know, my attorneys put in a motion to the Superior Court and won a ruling removing me from solitary confinement and moving me to general population.
If you can tell our listeners a little bit more about what it was like spending time on death row in solitary confinement, in particular, knowing that you're innocent of the crime for which you were convicted.
I'm pugnacious, so I never gave up. You know, I was always willing to meet, you know, whatever demands were placed upon my person. And I had faith. You know, I worked hard every day. Every day I worked hard. And I knew in my heart that eventually it would be proven. Like, there's nothing that's done in the darkness that won't come to light. It's just a matter of time.
If I could add to that, Isaiah McCoy is a truly remarkable individual. I mean, in addition to his intellectual ability, which is significant, he has great strength, and I think Herb and I have always been impressed with his just ability to sort of, you know, stay in the game at points where, you know, people with lesser abilities and lesser fortitude might have given up. And, you know, they made offers to Isaiah to plead guilty before the retrial, and they were decent offers, I mean, from a lawyer perspective. And yet he was just adamant that he didn't do this and he was going to see it through, and he just retained confidence, although I'm not sure why he had confidence in the system. He retained confidence in the system that it would vindicate him eventually. And it was truly remarkable to watch that over the course of my year and a half on the case.
That's very interesting, Michael, and I'd like to follow up on that. You became involved in the case after Herb and his co-counsel won the remand out of the Delaware Supreme Court, correct?
Yeah, that's right.
I understand that, Isaiah, you decided to be tried by a judge instead of a jury when you had your retrial. And I was wondering, whoever wants to talk about that, if you could explain that process and explain that to our listeners about the difference between being tried by a jury versus a judge and what decisions you made around that.
Well, let me say this. You know, I've been doing criminal defense for about 35 years. The idea of waiving a jury in a capital homicide case, or it wasn't capital, fortunately, by the time we went to trial because of the abolition of the death penalty in Delaware, but for a good chunk of the time it was capital. The idea of waiving a jury in any trial, much less a homicide trial, was just, you know, to me it was a non-starter. I kind of laughed when Herb said to me, oh, Isaiah's talking about waiving a jury. I was like, yeah, right. As I did many times during this case, I underestimated Mr. McCoy's reasoning and his will. I'll let Isaiah explain to you what his thinking was. I should say that the results certainly vindicated Isaiah's decision when this judge found him not guilty. I think Isaiah could probably speak to the reasoning better than I.
Well, my thought process was I had already went before a jury in the first trial, and I felt like the evidence was very, very clear that I was innocent even in the first trial. So I felt like a judge, you know, actually being a legal expert in knowing how to deal in the facts, I felt like he would come to the proper conclusion. Further, we were appointed Judge Robert B. Young, and I already had experience with him, and I felt like he was one of the best judges in the state. I felt like he was very fair, ethical, honorable, you know, a man that participates in with the Delaware Bar, the American Bar Association. We were dealing in facts, but we're not trying to deceive anyone. We just wanted to put the facts out there because we felt that the facts, you know, would prove my innocence.
Robin, if I may, I remember visiting with Mr. McCoy in prison when he told me he wanted to waive the jury and go with Judge Young. And I remember driving home and thinking, like so many times after I met with Mr. McCoy, thinking to myself, man, I wish I thought of that. It instantly struck me as a really, as an excellent strategy. I'm not, like Michael is a seasoned death penalty lawyer. I'm not a seasoned death penalty lawyer. I'm more of a general practice kind of guy. And I feel like Isaiah, we had the perfect judge for this. Kent County is one of the three Delaware counties. It's in the southern part of the state. It's a tough place for an African-American guy to get a fair trial, I believe. And I thought that Isaiah's decision was right on. And again, it was borne out by the result.
Yeah. And just for the record, Mr. Mondros often says that he's not a seasoned in this field. But Mr. Mondros got two people off death row in around 6 months. That is phenomenal. You know, but he's very humble, you know. Humility is his friend, so I just wanted to point that out.
It's good for the self-esteem.
Thank you. Now, you mentioned, Michael, that this was no longer a death case because the death penalty had been abolished in Delaware. Can you tell our listeners about that situation and what's happened in Delaware recently?
Sure. Over the summer of 2016, the Delaware Supreme Court decided a case called Rauf, R-A-U-F, which essentially abolished capital punishment in Delaware under the existing statute, which the court found to have been infirm for the same reasons as in the Hearst case in Florida. Delaware was one of the few places in the country that had judge overrides, and so it was found to be infirm for those reasons because of the override.
Let me pause for a moment to give background to our listeners who are not familiar with the case Michael mentioned. Hearst versus Florida was a case decided by the United States Supreme Court in which a capital prisoner challenged the constitutionality of Florida's capital sentencing scheme. In Florida, like Delaware, a jury would recommend a sentence in a death penalty case, but a judge could override that recommendation. In January 2016, the United States Supreme Court found Florida's capital sentencing scheme in violation of the Sixth Amendment, which guarantees the right to trial by jury. The court held that the Sixth Amendment requires a jury, not a judge, to find each fact necessary to impose a sentence of death. In light of the United States Supreme Court's ruling, both the Florida Supreme Court and the Delaware Supreme Court have determined that in capital cases, a jury verdict for death must be unanimous and that a judge cannot override the jury's recommendation. So, Michael, will the Delaware Supreme Court decision stand, or can the state appeal that decision?
The state did not seek cert from the U.S. Supreme Court, which was a welcome surprise to all of us following it. And the Delaware Supreme Court subsequently held their Rauf decision, R-A-U-F, to be retroactive. So Delaware's row was cleared off. There were about a dozen, 15 guys sentenced to death who are no longer sentenced to death. So as we speak now, there is no death penalty statute in Delaware. We're all hoping that it stays that way. If I could add one more thing just about the removal of the death penalty. You know, if I said it once, I must have said it a dozen times to Herb and to our investigator, Philip Primison, who is out of New York, who is acting as our mitigator as well as our investigator, that, you know, the fact that we did not have to prepare for a penalty phase after the Rauf decision was so utterly liberating to us. I mean, the pressures we felt trying this case as non-capital were great enough. I can hardly imagine what we would have been feeling like if we were also looking at a potential penalty phase. So it really made a difference, I think, in our ability to present the guilt phase of the case.
Isaiah, I want to know, what was your first thought when you heard the judge's ruling saying that he was finding you not guilty in your retrial?
I felt the decision would be proper probably 30% of the way through his ruling. So it was kind of like an out-of-body experience, kind of, you know. The last thing I recall is there was a roll of questions that I had asked during the first trial that Mr. Wiseman had asked again. And when the judge, you know, specifically pointed that area out, Mr. Wiseman squeezed my arm. And that's pretty much the last thing I remember. And then there was moments before the judge began to discuss his decision. Mr. Wiseman had wrote a quote by Dr. King on a piece of paper and placed it in front of me. I think the exact wording was, "The arc of history is long, but it bends towards justice."
That's right.
You know, and that was deep in my mind. And also my pugnacity tank, you know, was still full. You know, we were prepared if the judge didn't make the proper decision, if more misconduct was committed, we were prepared to continue our fight. And I would just, you know, it's hard to explain how I felt because it just was surreal.
Let me give you a counterpoint to that. As we did frequently during the course of the trial, we would go to the holding cells during breaks and speak with Isaiah. His utter confidence in his position and the rightfulness of his cause were ever present. I do recall distinctly when the group of us went down to see him over the judge essentially heard closing argument and adjourned for a couple hours to render his verdict. During that couple hours, we went down, and I think for the very first time, I detected in Isaiah's eyes, understandably, quite a bit of nervousness and trepidation. And he may deny that, but I saw it. And so, we were all nervous, obviously. And again, unlike Isaiah, the judge read about a six-page statement into the record in support of his verdict, I think he was about 5.5 pages in before I felt like it was clear which way he was going. I don't recall feeling that way 30% in like Isaiah did. But just one more point, the role of Questions Isaiah is referring to, I called it the McCoy role. In his first trial, he was examining the assigned detective. And when I was reading that, I was like, oh, my God, this is like the best cross I've ever seen of a cop. And I literally lifted those questions verbatim from the first trial and used them in my examination of the cop in the second trial. So that's what he's referring to when he says the Isaiah role was those that series of questions, which essentially established that they had nothing on him other than the testimony of the two snitches in this case. No objective, reliable evidence.
So explain to our listeners. I think everybody's familiar with the jury system, and we've seen stuff on TV where the jury goes out and you're waiting for the jury to come back with a verdict. What was it like? Did the judge leave the bench? Was he off the bench for a while? How long did it take between the end of trial and him reading his verdict?
It was 2 hours. I mean, we spent that last morning doing argument. You know, he said, okay, I wasn't sure if he was going to say come back in a week or whatever, but I think we were all relieved when he said come back at 2 o'clock and I'll have my verdict, hope to have my verdict. Needless to say, that's a torturous time for any litigant, any lawyer representing someone. You know, you just try to pass the time. It's torture.
The longest 2 hours of your life, right?
Well, certainly of Isaiah's life. I've lost many cases before, so the longest of my life, but it was nerve-wracking.
How long after you were pronounced not guilty did it take for you to get processed out of the system, Isaiah? Did you get to go home that day?
Yeah, DOC took their time. You know, the verdict came in about 2 o'clock, and they didn't release me to about 11 at night.
I'm going to tell a story that I know Herb is not going to tell because he's too modest, but we showed up at Gander Hill, which is the prison that Isaiah was being discharged from, and there was a CO outside who saw Herb. Now, Herb, mind you, had just been there a few months before getting another Delaware death row prisoner off of death row named Jermaine Wright. And so this guard didn't realize Herb was a lawyer, thought he was like some special driver who came to pick up guys getting out of death row. So we had this image of like Herb standing there with the chauffeur sign, you know, saying, Mr. McCoy, Mr. McCoy. But it was pretty funny. But yeah, the three of us, Herb and myself and Phil Primison, we were waiting outside, and then Isaiah's daughter showed up with her mother, his little daughter, and, you know, they were patiently waiting for Daddy to get out. As the father of a little girl, I remember so fondly those images of my daughter running up to me saying, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And that's exactly what happened when Isaiah showed his face at the gate. His daughter broke free from her mom and just ran to the gate screaming, Daddy, Daddy, Daddy. And gosh, it was pretty special.
Oh, wow. Wow. Do you have anything to add to that, Isaiah?
Oh, it was just... I don't think you could have made up a better story. I don't think that even... I think that if you just read it without knowing the facts, you would probably think it was fictional because it all came together so perfect.
Well, let me ask you this going forward. After experiencing a wrongful conviction and, you know, spending time on death row for a crime you didn't commit, what changes would you like to see in our legal system to try to prevent this from happening to other people?
One of the first changes I would like made is referred to the Attorney General's office or District Attorney's office, which is if you're going to go to trial and merely seek a conviction instead of seeking justice as you're supposed to, let's change the name. No longer let it be Mr. McCoy versus State. Let it be Mr. McCoy versus the Office of Conviction. You know, because when you use the state or the federal government, you know, and you become an agent of them, you know, it gives you a lot of prestige and a lot of power that I don't think you deserve if you're not rightfully seeking justice. You know, it's just a lot of these prosecutors, they built a culture at their offices where they don't care whether or not a person is guilty or innocent. You know, their only goal is to win by any means necessary. So I think that's something that we must change. You know, we must change in order for the scales of justice to be even. And further, just speak briefly on mass incarceration. You know, the incarceration rate for African Americans and people in America right now is just unacceptable. You know, there are a lot of innocent people that are incarcerated, but some of them don't have the intellectual capacity to fight back or protect themselves. And, you know, there's not that many attorneys, you know, that can perform these duties. So these people are left kind of like left to the wolves, you know, left to rot inside of prison cells, you know. And I would like that to change. The conditions of the prisoners needed to change. You know, at the prisons in Delaware, pretrial inmates, detainees, aren't even allowed to go to the law library. They're only allowed to go to the law library once they're convicted. And that makes no sense. So rather than allowing a person to educate themselves so that they can avoid the conviction, you wait until they get convicted, and then now you can check it. Like, it makes it so much harder to actually obtain justice and to get your due when that is the procedure that the jails have in place. And then also, I feel like DOC and Attorney General's office, they work together to really make things hard, you know, because you're already dealing with a lot with the prosecutor. They're very unreasonable. But then at the prison, they're very unreasonable, you know, with your legal visits, with your legal mail, with everything there is to keep you mentally stable so that you can participate in your defense.
Isaiah, what would you advise to someone, what advice would you give to someone who has been wrongfully convicted?
My advice would be to read. You know, if you're able to comprehend, to read, there's so many different organizations out here that's willing to help. Reach out to those organizations. And you got to be steadfast. As much as you might want to take a plea just to get it over with, sometimes you got to stick by it, and you got to constantly be on it. You know, all the people that I know that didn't commit the crime were in the law library as much as possible, reading as much as possible, trying to gain understanding, you know, on their case. You got to know the facts of your case better than anyone else, even more than your attorneys, your investigators, the attorney general, the judge, you know. And once you do that, then you're prepared, you know, that when fortune, you know, turns your way, you'll be prepared.
And Michael and Herb, do you have any additional thoughts regarding what type of legal reforms could reduce the chance of wrongful convictions, especially in death penalty cases?
Well, sure. You know, I mean, this case is like many other exoneration cases in that, you know, there's some common themes and, you know, the use of incentivized witnesses, which of course is the fancy term for snitches or accomplices, you know, was present in this case. I mean, the only two witnesses against Isaiah both got deals, very favorable deals. They both told an incredible number of different stories, and I'm not talking about minor inconsistencies that one might expect, but just significant changes in their stories. In fact, at one point we said to the Attorney General, how many lies does a witness have to tell before your office just won't use them? And that was after they revealed to us that one of the witnesses had told them in preparation that they had lied at the first trial about a material fact. So certainly incentivized witnesses are terrible. I mean, there should be a heightened standard for their use, and maybe they shouldn't even be permitted in capital cases just because of the stakes involved. I think that, you know, obviously prosecutorial misconduct is another theme that was present in this case. And, you know, when a prosecutor behaves badly, they should be held accountable. Fortunately, the prosecutor in this case was, but in many jurisdictions, that's not the case. So I think those two things come to my mind from this case.
And Herb, do you have anything to add?
A couple of things. First, this was a supposed drug deal gone bad. That was the state's theory of the case. It was supported by the only evidence that Mr. McCoy was involved came from the two actual perpetrators of the crime. They call it accomplice testimony. It should be called perpetrator testimony. That this was ever a death penalty case, you know, given the circumstances of the crime and the lack of evidence against Mr. McCoy is outrageous. And I guess that's my main comment there. You know, this it's just a textbook case as to why the death penalty is not a good idea.
My last question is for Isaiah, and I think probably our listeners want to know, what are you going to do now, and what are your hopes for the future? You know, what do you hope to do now with the rest of your life?
There are several things in acting as an activist, you know, on behalf of prisoners, on behalf of the mass incarceration movement. There was recently an incident that took place at Smyrna Prison in Delaware where an officer was held hostage and an officer was actually killed during an ordeal. I've been protesting, giving interviews, and really I want to give the public the true outlook on the inside, what actually goes on, what actually takes place. And I really want to protect the rights of all people, you know, not just prisoners, you know, correctional officers, you know, police, you know, everyone, you know, just I feel like everyone deserves to be treated equally. You know, everybody deserves to be treated in a humane manner. And I'll be going any and everywhere where there's an incident, you know, to protest, to let my voice be heard. Further, I'm in the midst of contacting attorneys throughout the nation where I can help on death penalty cases, whether or not it's just, you know, speaking to the actual defendant, you know, and bridging that gap that sometimes exists between the attorneys and the defendant. And after all this time of dealing with a death penalty case, a capital case, I've become somewhat of an expert. So I'm really ready to give my advice and really help other innocent people throughout the nation.
Well, you certainly have a lot of work to do ahead of you.
Yes, ma'am. And I was fortunate enough to, you know, my attorneys recaptured my freedom in record time. I'm only 29 years old, so I'm young. I have a lot of energy, and I'm up to the task of fighting for the rights of others, you know, wherever I'm needed.
Great. Well, thank you all for joining us today. It's been very insightful, and this has been great to talk to you.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Rob.
Thank you all for listening to Discussions with DPIC. To learn more about the death penalty and others who have been exonerated, visit our website at deathpenaltyinfo.org. To make sure that you receive every episode of our podcast, subscribe on iTunes or your podcast app of choice.